Chapter 21. From Bletchley Blethering's, May 1941. Sound of singing heard from Knox's section recently. Intoxicated singing, if BB is any judge.
"Not a one of your fillies can carry a tune in a bucket," Dilly remarked. "Thank God you can break codes."
He conducted them with his pipe as they roared on with the next verse of his poem, specially written for the occasion.
"When Cunningham won at Mattapan, by the grace of God and Margaret, it was thanks to that girl, the Admiral said, that our aeroplanes straddled their target."
Peggy Rock shook her head, smiling, as Beth and the others shouted her name. Every woman in the cottage had a verse of her own.
"When Cunningham won at Mattapan, by the grace of God and Beth, she's the girl who found the planes, our ships did their never-death."
"I didn't really find the planes," Beth objected. "I found the coordinates."
"Try making coordinates rhyme with anything," Peggy replied.
"Estimates," Beth said instantly. "Bifurcates, expectorates."
Peggy threw a wine cork at her. It was the first real opportunity they'd all had to celebrate their triumph. During those heady days after the victory, there had been new work to do. But today, Dilly had sent Beth and Peggy down to the Eight Bells pub to bring back as much wine as they could carry. Admiral Sir Andrew Cunningham himself, hero of Mattapan, was coming to Bletchley Park to personally thank Dilly and his team. When they finished singing, they raised their glasses to their boss.
"To Dilly Knox," said Peggy, "the reason we're all here."
Dilly took his glasses off, blinking rather hard.
"Well now," he said, "well now."
They crowded around him in a rush. Beth pushed down her dislike of being touched so she could hug everyone within reach. Her throat was so choked with feeling she could hardly breathe.
"Oh, Lord," someone called in sudden panic. "Is that the Admiral? I swear I heard a staff car."
They were all lined up outside the cottage, very serious and well-combed, and slightly squiffy on bad Chablis. By the time Admiral Cunningham in his gold-braided uniform came stalking along with a smiling Commander Denniston, Beth could hardly look the great man in the face as he shook hands down the line.
"We have had a great victory in the Mediterranean," he said at the end,
holding the glass someone had managed to find for the nasty wine.
"And it is entirely due to Dilly Knox and his girls."
A very solemn moment, broken when the Admiral turned and Beth saw the back of his immaculate dark uniform was blotched with white.
"The cottage was just whitewashed," giggled two of the younger women. "We manoeuvred him to brush against the wall. That's no way to treat an Admiral."
But Beth found laughter rising in her like golden bubbles, the triumph and the unaccustomed drink going to her head. And when the hero of the Mediterranean realized what had happened and shook his head in rueful amusement, Dilly's entire team burst into howls of laughter. Beth was still smiling as she let herself in the door at home.
"Not much to smile about from where I'm standing," her mother sighed. "It'll be tripe and liver hot pot for supper if I can't find an onion at the shop, and an entire basket of socks to darn.
I'll do it."
Beth kissed her mother's cheek.
"I met an admiral today, Mother. He said his victory was entirely due to me and the people I work with."
She wanted to say it so badly. She wanted her mother to be proud. All she could do was offer to darn socks.
"Take that dog outside," Mrs.
Finch warned, collecting her shopping basket.
"I swear it's waiting for me to turn my back so it can make a mess."
Beth still couldn't believe she'd won in the matter of the dog. If it hadn't been for that strange, exhilarated exhaustion that gripped her after breaking the Italian battle plan, her mother hadn't even quoted Deuteronomy to her the following day. Even Deuteronomy apparently had nothing to say about daughters who stayed out for 3 nights on shift work. The dog was seemingly just one more straw on the heap.
"You know, a dog keeps burglars away,"
Mab had told Mrs. Finch with a dark look, implying hordes of would-be intruders. And Osler had launched a long, drawling anecdote about how
Princess Margaret has a topping little dog like that. Did you see in the Tatler?
So the dog stayed, and Beth took him outside with the basket of socks so she could do her darning on the sunny front stoop.
"Funny looking dog,"
the next door neighbour said as the schnauzer trundled crossly around Mrs. Finch's immaculate victory garden.
"What's his name?"
"Boots."
The name had been an accident. Mab had asked, "What will you call him?" And Beth, still exhausted from code-breaking and expecting the question, "Where did you find him?" had mumbled, "Boots."
since she'd picked him up outside the chemist's. Osler and Mab came swinging through the front gate in their blush pink and smoke blue coats, passing Mrs. Finch as she departed for the grocer.
"Isn't this sun bliss?"
Mab sat down on the front step beside Beth.
"Did you hear there's a dance in Bedford? An American band. They've got all the latest Glenn Miller tunes."
"Who?" Beth asked, rummaging for yarn.
"Told you she wouldn't know who that was."
Osler grinned, sitting on Beth's other side.
"Brains like hers are too busy keeping up with brilliant things to get chuffed about the latest tunes."
"It doesn't take brilliance, the sort of thing I do. Just sideways thinking. Here." Beth hesitated, looking around. No one in earshot. Pushing the darning basket aside, she pulled out a scrap of paper and sketched quickly.
"This is a visionaire cipher. Dilly has me doing them for practice in my spare time. It's a historic code-breaking exercise, miles different from what we do now, so it's nothing you aren't allowed to know. I'll have you solving one in 20 minutes.
Still buoyed up by the cottage celebration, the wine and the Admiral's handshake, Beth had an unaccustomed urge to share what she could do.
"Here's how to crack it using a key, though it can be done without."
She demonstrated. Mab and Osler both had a go, half laughing and half fascinated. It took longer than 20 minutes, but eventually they both cracked it.
"See? Not so hard."
"I'd like to show this to all those fellows making jabs about the debutante's den."
Osler looked at her visionaire cipher.
"Hitler really would pitch an absolute screamer if he knew a lot of girls scratching pencils in Bletchley are turning this war inside out."
"These have knelled your fall and ruin, but your ears were far away," Beth quoted one of Dilly's irreverent verses. "English lassies rustling papers through the sodden Bletchley day."
"Well, these lassies are going to the dance in Bedford," Mab declared. "We deserve some fun, and so do you, Beth."
"You know she won't go," Osler smiled. "That shot is not on the board, darling."
To Beth's surprise, she heard herself speak.
"I'll go."
Within the hour, she was regretting the decision.
"You have no idea how long I've been wanting to get my hands on these," Osler said, going at Beth's eyebrows with tweezers.
"Ow!
Stop kicking up a shindy, Beth. You have to suffer to be beautiful."
Mab, having shooed boots off the bed and flung every dress Beth owned across it, held up a navy blue crepe.
"This one. It's the only thing you own that isn't brown, beige, or puce. All colours you should never wear, Beth, because they make you look like a couch.
What I wouldn't give to put you in something bright.
We'll loan her my purple satin," Osler suggested, plucking ruthlessly.
"Too small."
"Your raspberry crepe?"
"Too big."
Mab shook out the navy blue professionally.
"I'll lend my red scarf. That'll add punch."
Beth yelped as another hair was yanked out. All her life she'd hated being looked at, squirmed from being touched, and now here she was being scrutinized and poked like a heifer in a stall. Even so, there was an odd fascination to the whole process. She glanced over Osler's shoulder at her own reflection in the mirror dubiously. Could even Osler and Mab make a difference in what she saw there?
"Topping complexion, but you need colour," Osler decreed. "Max Factor pancake base, a swipe of my Elizabeth Arden Victory Red.
Mother says women who wear lipstick are tarts."
"And she's so right about that. You're going to make a spiffing tart."
"Right. About this hair."
Mab had already unwoven Beth's long plait. She ran her fingers through the thin, dishwater blonde waves.
"If we lop off the bottom 6 inches, don't give me that face. I cut my sister's hair all the time.
My mother will kill me."
"Beth," Osler said severely, "if you say the words my mother again, I will knock you into next week. Poke her up here, grow a spine, put on lipstick."
"I've changed my mind."
Beth tried to rise.
"I don't want to go."
But it was far, far too late. Her friends had identical, slightly mad gleams in their eyes, and the bit in their teeth. Her moment of rebellion collapsed back into unwilling fascination as she was stripped and whirled, plucked and pinned. 6 inches of her hair disappeared in a few snips. And then Osler wrestled Beth's limp locks into Kirby grips as Mab basted a new hem on Beth's navy blue dress.
"Too short," Beth yelped.
"Nonsense," Mab scolded, stitching away. "You have legs, Beth. You're a bit flat up front, and you haven't got much hip, but you have legs, and they are good legs, and tonight they're going to be seen."
"No, Yes, her friends said ruthlessly. By the time they were done, the navy blue dress was unrecognizable, hem hitting Beth's knees, neckline framed by Mab's red scarf, skirt flared out by Osler's red silk petticoat. It'll swish and flash around those shapely legs when you walk. Beth stared at herself cautiously. Not exactly duckling to swan. No amount of plucking and tailoring and silk flounces was going to give her Mab's figure or Osler's sparkle. But she didn't look as ghastly as she'd feared. We'll give you Veronica Lake hair, Mab decreed, taking out the Kirby grips. You always duck your chin when you meet strangers. With a wave of air over one eye to hide behind, you look mysterious rather than shy. She combed and parted and fluffed. What do you think? My mother will hate it, Beth thought. But, well, maybe it wasn't so bad. The other two were shimmying into their own dresses now, Mab's of violent blue-purple that nipped around her long figure like a lightning bolt. It's an old curtain liner I found in Mum's rag bag last time I was in London. It lasts about 3 washings. Darling, only you and Scarlett O'Hara could dress in a curtain and still look scrummy. Osler hooked her stockings to her suspender belt. I can't be bothered what I wear. Just hand me that rose print. Now, Beth, when Mab and I distract your mother, you run out the back while we tell her you're tucked up in bed with a headache. I am going to hell, Beth thought as they all spun through a spritz of Osler's Soir de Paris. But that didn't stop her from kissing Boots goodbye and grabbing her coat.
Right ho, on our way,
Giles said as they all piled into his car in the pitch-black street.
I say, is that our Beth? Save me a dance, gorgeous.
I don't know how to dance, Beth said. Even if I did, I'd probably hate it.
And the dance was every bit as noisy and crowded as she'd feared, a big room packed to the ceiling with servicemen and local girls. Beth could barely see the stage where the band was playing Tuxedo Junction. Giles and Mab whizzed off to the floor. And when Beth saw how Osler's feet tapped in their little diamante-studded pumps, she urged her, go dance. The thought of sitting alone was alarming, but not as cringe-making as forcing her friends to nanny her all night. As soon as Osler was whisked away, Beth found herself a chair on the side. A tow-headed boy leaned over, breathing gin fumes.
Fancy a spin, Veronica Lake?
No, thank you.
Beth couldn't say she enjoyed being in the middle of a crowd, but she found she could sit with the froth of silk petticoat rustling deliciously around her knees and let her eyes follow the dancers as the music swirled. The skirts of the women opening like flowers, the men with buttons and bars on their uniforms flashing. She could almost see patterns in it, like the rose petal spirals, or the patterns of brick in a wall.
Hello there.
Harry flopped into the chair beside hers, big and cheerful, black hair dishevelled. He didn't look surprised at her change of appearance, or seem to notice it at all. Beth smiled, realizing she rather liked that. Giles's swoony double take had felt a bit insulting. Did she ordinarily look such a fright? Obviously I do. But if so, Harry hadn't noticed that either, and she was glad.
Didn't think I'd see you here,
he continued, linking an elbow over the back of his chair.
Why not? Am I such a wet blanket?
No, but you hate crowds.
Osler and Mab dragged me out.
Beth peered up at Harry through her new wave of hair, and wished she could ask how the Italian naval enigma compared to the German naval enigma his hut worked on. But you couldn't talk code-breaking in a crowd full of outsiders. So Beth rummaged for small talk.
Did your wife come along tonight?
Sheila's at home with Christopher. Last night she was off at a concert with a friend, so tonight she shoved me out the door and told me to enjoy myself.
He spoke with a complete lack of self-pity, but Beth's tongue still froze with unexpressed sympathy. Having a child so frail, he always needed one of you hovering.
Do you think America will join the war?
Beth ventured, for something less personal.
They'd better.
His expression darkened.
The wolf packs are making mincemeat of us.
Another conversational dead end. Beth could have talked clicks and lobsters all day, but ordinary small talk felt like swimming upstream. I suppose it's better than the days when all conversation felt like swimming upstream. The band swung into In the Mood, and a bass riff growled out across the floor.
They're good,
Beth said, for lack of anything else to say.
It's not bad, but I like music a bit more orderly. Patterns, you know. Harry grinned as she gave him a startled look. You too. I had a feeling. I don't know if that's the way our brains were already wired, or if it's pure habit after what we do all day. Give me Bach any time. There are patterns for days in the well-tempered clavier.
I've never heard it.
In Cambridge, I had a job at a music shop. Between customers, I listened with headphones on. Made me very cross if someone came browsing when I was in the middle of a symphony.
I've never been to Cambridge. I've never been anywhere.
In the mood ended, and the dancers broke up. Some flooded to the side. Some grabbed new partners as Moonlight Serenade rippled over the floor. Harry cocked his head. Care to take a whirl?
I don't really want to dance, Beth confessed. I want to be back at work.
Me too. People like you and me, we're more hooked than opium fiends. They traded rueful, frustrated smiles. She could tell they were both itching to talk about things they shouldn't. Come on, Harry said in a sudden burst. Tugging Beth out to the dance floor, Harry snugged her in briskly with an arm about her waist, took her hand in his big one, and began to revolve to the slow, dreamy tune. No one will hear if we talk like this. He lowered his head to hers, voice mischievous and friendly in her ear. I've got some new tricks for working cribs, nothing too specific to naval section. Want to hear? Beth hesitated, but every other couple around them swayed with eyes closed, and he was murmuring right into her ear. Even the most dedicated eavesdropper wasn't going to hear a thing over the music.
Yes, please,
she whispered back with a smile of her own, relaxing into the arm around her waist. So, I've been working a four-wheel machine. Beth listened, the music a bright, brassy pattern over the pattern Harry's words were weaving. She could almost see it if she closed her eyes.
Dilly has me working visionaire squares.
I've done those. Can you break them without a key?
Easy as pie.
Christ, you're good. What about... Look at you two whispering away. Giles tapped Harry on the arm. May I cut in?
No, thank you, Beth said firmly.
She leaned back into Harry's shoulder, wanting to dissect visionaire squares and four-wheel enigmas, barely hearing Giles retreat with a laughing, All right, keep your secrets. 11 days until the royal wedding. November 9, 1947. Chapter 22. Inside the clock. One of the orderlies had red hair like Giles. Beth watched him go about his evening rounds, restocking closets, collecting dirty linen, laughing with a friend. Beth remembered Giles's voice. Keep your secrets. Were you the one with secrets? She wondered for the 1,000th time. Giles, the ever-friendly, the eternal gossip. Giles, who had eventually been transferred from Hut 6 to Knox's section. Giles, drollest of the Mad Hatters. She didn't want it to be him, but she didn't want it to be any of her friends. The red-haired orderly left the common room, and Beth slipped after him.
What do you want, Liddell? He said, low-voiced. Cigarettes? Scent? It'll cost you.
Something else Beth had learned in her years here, which of the orderlies and nurses would trade covertly with the patients. Hoarded medicines could buy you drink, cosmetics, or knowledge.
I need information.
Beth swallowed hard, damp palms rubbing down her smock.
What is a lobotomy?
His brows rose.
Why?
I'm scheduled for one and I don't know what it is. The unease had lingered all evening since she'd heard that whispered fragment from the matrons. None of the women in the ward had any facts, only speculation.
Tell me.
That's big information.
He leaned in. Beth smelled sweat and Lysol.
What have you got for me?
She swallowed again, bile this time, as she tugged him toward the nearest linen closet.
Come in here, and I'll show you.
That was something else she'd learned. Which of the orderlies would grope under your smock if no one was looking? How to avoid them and their grabbing hands, how to bite and kick if they maneuvered you alone. And which of the orderlies wouldn't force you, but wouldn't say no if you offered. Sometimes, if it got you something you needed, you offered. It wasn't the first time Beth had gone to her knees in a linen closet, but her stomach roiled with just as much helpless, viscous rage as it had the first time.
What is a lobotomy?
she asked before she got started, voice rasping like a rusty knife.
A head surgery,
the orderly said, closing his eyes and slipping his hand into her hair.
Just a little tap to the skull, I've heard. It's done all the time in America. Yes, keep going.
Beth stopped, withdrawing.
What is this surgery for?
Just finish me off.
No, not until you tell me what this surgery does.
What does anything do here? It'll make you better, fix you. I wouldn't worry, Liddell, he added, sounding sincere.
It's not too invasive, they say. Nowhere near as bad as them electric treatments you hear about.
Beth pressed, asking more questions, but he clearly didn't know anything more. She closed her eyes and finished things, thinking of her go-playing companion drawing a finger like a scalpel over her skull.
A good girl.
He fastened up his trousers, ruffling her hair.
Get back to your cell now.
Beth sat back on her heels as he slipped out of the closet, red hair a winking gleam in the brief light flash from the door. She tried not to gag, smelling bleach from the folded sheets all around, lungs full of sudden fear. A surgery and a traitor to contend with, and she had no idea what or who they were, or if she would have any help in dealing with either.
Osla, Mab, where are you?
York. Betty's tea shop, Osla had said over the telephone. Tomorrow, 2 o'clock, we'll talk.
Bugger that, Mab had told her, ringing off with a bang, and gone to check on the children.
Eddie was a warm, soft weight against Mab's breast as she lifted him from his bed. He was fretful, fussing from his nap, but he settled quickly against her. She inhaled the smell of talcum and little boy, wondering if he was heavier than he'd been just last night. He was growing so fast, 18 months and already bigger than most 2-year-olds. He'd be a 6-footer for sure. Mab tiptoed out of the nursery, passing a hand over Lucy's dark head. Luce was a restless sleeper, kicking her sheets off and muttering, but she stilled at Mab's hand on her hair. Mab fed Eddie downstairs, avoiding the peas he tried to spit out onto her cream linen blouse. But afterward, as she sat him down to play with the toy train his father had made for him, she couldn't settle. She stood turning an unlit cigarette between her fingers. She was trying to quit, stomach churning as Beth's cipher message echoed through her mind. There couldn't have been a traitor at Bletchley Park. Candidates were vetted before they were even invited to interview. When she transferred from the bomb machines to the mansion, Mab had heard about the boxes and boxes of MI5 files in Hut 9. And if there was a traitor, who were they selling to? BP had remained safe, secret, and successful throughout the war, which argued against the Germans ever having found out. No. The cipher message's accusation was either a madwoman's paranoid fantasies or the lies of a desperate woman willing to say anything to get free. Either way, what happens to me if I help her? Mab thought. Beth was locked up on the government's orders. Communicating with her could be a violation of Mab's oath. Receiving and encouraging insecure communications of privileged information, or however they might phrase it. But it could mean prison. Mab looked around her quiet sitting room. This home, this family, this life was everything young Mabel Chert from Shoreditch had ever dreamed of. Her house with its 3 stories of mellowed Yorkshire stone, and its surrounding garden of bramble roses. Her marble-tiled bathroom crowded with perfume vials and cosmetics, rather than a shared toilet down the hall. Her own bank account, with a balance she no longer compulsively checked to make absolutely certain there was enough for the electric bill, for Eddie's new shoes, for Lucy's future education. Her husband. Risk all of this, risk her family, risk a cell, for Beth, who had betrayed her during the war. What did she risk to ask for your help? The thought whispered. What is she risking now?
6 years ago. May, 1941. Chapter 23.
Out with it, Beth, said Mab.
Beth blinked, holding the red silk petticoat she'd tiptoed into the room to return, and so did Osla, who sat buffing her nails by the light of a candle stub. The three of them had only just sneaked back in from the dance, absolutely knackered, long past Mrs. Finch's lights out. And mentally, Osler was already trotting up the next Bletchley Blethering's.
What shy filly splashed out at the Bedford dance this weekend?
Even the most brilliant brain needs a little Glenn Miller to invigorate the old grey matter, and BP's boffin certainly sat up and took notice. You danced 5 times with Harry, Beth. Mab turned away from the glass where she'd been brushing her hair and fixed Beth with a stern eye. All slow, swoony tunes, too. Beth closed the bedroom door as Boots trundled in on her heels. We were talking shop, you know, code-breaking, Osla knew she meant, but wouldn't say, even here in private. Cheek to cheek, Osla couldn't help saying. Beth looked puzzled. Yes, so no one could overhear. Back in her high-necked nightdress, with her hair combed out of its waves, she looked very much the colourless wallflower who had never been on a date in her life. Osla sighed. Don't tell me you've gone moony over Harry Zarb. Beth looked horrified. We've worked together, that's all. He's good at what he does. I'm good at what I do. It's easy to talk. Osla and Mab exchanged glances. That's called getting moony. Mab tossed her brush down. High time you started looking about for a fellow, Beth, but don't settle for a married man giving you a line. There was no line. Beth reached for the end of her plait to fidget with, but it was no longer there. He didn't try anything. He only asked me to dance so we could talk safely, no one hearing. Only at BP. Mab settled on her own bed in her nylon slip. Not let me whisper sweet nothings in your ear, but let me whisper ciphers in your ear. It doesn't mean it still wasn't a line, Beth. Osler wasn't sure. Was Harry really the sort to step out when he had nice, tired-looking Sheila at home, looking after their frail son and his leg braces? She wasn't so worried he would try things on with Beth. More like Beth would get all starry for the first man who flirted through Moonlight Serenade without meaning anything serious by it. You can never predict what kind of man steps out on his wife, Mab said, as though reading Osler's mind. That's why you steer clear of all married men, because it starts as a harmless friendship, and then you're hearing how their wife doesn't understand them, and they're going to leave her soon, and then you're sneaking off behind the wife's back until things get sorted, which they never do. It's all rubbish. I've never got into that situation, she added, seeing the look on their faces. But I've known girls who did, and their stories all turned out the same. Not at the altar, because the men were just looking for a bit of, you know... Bit of what? Beth asked, perched on the edge of Osler's bed. You know, Mab looked at her. Don't you?
No.
Osler stared down at her hands. Actually, she heard herself saying, I don't either. About it. She could barely get the words out, but she couldn't lie either, not in this blackout-curtained bedroom with two girls she'd worked with and wept with and shared untold fears with for the last year. Come off it, Mab scoffed. I'll believe that Beth here never learned the facts of life from Mrs. Finch. Though didn't your sisters tell you after they married? She demanded, sidetracked. Beth looked blank. They said never to let a boy kiss me until we were engaged, so I thought maybe kissing made you pregnant. Methodists, Mab muttered, and looked at Osler. All right, I believe Beth, but I don't see how you can possibly be in the same boat, considering that racy mother of yours, you dizzy Deb. Don't call me that, Osler flared, knowing she was being oversensitive, not particularly caring. She was tired, tired, tired of climbing an endless ladder where she thought she'd finally reached a rung where she'd never be called Dizzy Deb or silly socialite again, only to find it still ringing in her ears, classifying her as dim-witted, inconsequential, ignorant. Only when it came to this, she was ignorant, no getting around it. You could spend your days translating Hitler's personal telegrams and still be an utter ignoramus in other spheres. You think my racy mother ever told me anything, Mab? I grew up surrounded by hirelings. Nannies taught me to wash behind my ears. Boarding school taught me German grammar. Finishing school taught me to make a court curtsy. My mother was too chuffed getting married, getting divorced, and getting remarried to notice I was there, much less teach me the facts of life. So I know nothing. And none of the girls I went to school with did either, because everyone's mothers were too terribly proper to get into the whole nasty subject. Mab still looked skeptical. The day we met, you embarrassed a pervert on the train by asking if he needed to hide the tent in his trousers. You think I had any idea what I was talking about? I fake being terribly worldly, darling, but it's all flim-flam. Osler looked down at her hands again.
At the Savoy last year, I was telling a friend that I wished my boyfriend wouldn't carry his torch in his front pocket when we danced. And this old dowager at the next table rears back and hisses at me, "You silly fool, don't you know what an erection is?" And I laughed like I knew what she meant, but I had not the foggiest. And now I'm 20 years old and in love, and I still have no idea how it happens. Osla ran out of breath, finally looking up. "I hate being such a silly Deb. Can you just enlighten me? Why do you think I know all about it?"
Mab looked peculiarly still in the light of the candle stub.
"Because Shoreditch girls are tarts." "No, because you didn't grow up wrapped in cotton wool like a china doll."
Osla realized she had utterly derailed the conversation from Beth and Harry and the conundrum of married men. But who knew when a chance like this would come again?
"What happens?"
There was a short, embarrassed silence. Boots broke it with a yelp because the scarlet-faced Beth was twisting her fingers through his collar. Mab looked between Osla and Beth and shook her head.
"We need a drink for this."
"Where'd you get that?"
Beth blurted as Mab rummaged in her handbag and brought out a silver flask.
"Nicked it off Giles. You'll never miss it."
Mab swigged. Osla swigged. Beth hesitated, but as soon as Mab said,
"All right, when a man's trousers come off,"
she reached for the flask and gulped till she choked. Osla pounded Beth on the back, and the two of them listened, cringing, to Mab's brief, blunt lecture.
"There are things you'll hear," she finished. "Anyone who says you can't get knocked up if it's your first time, wrong. Anyone who says you can't get knocked up if a man pulls away at the end, also wrong. The only thing that stops you getting knocked up is if a man wears a French letter."
A brief explanation of what that was. Osla and Beth made faces.
"Or if you get a doctor to fit you for a little rubber device you push up inside."
She mimed.
"But no doctor will give you that until you're married, or at least engaged, because doctors are men. And if a man promises he'll marry you if you do it with him, that's a lie that's been told since Adam and Eve."
"Well," Osla said at last, "I can't say I'm tempted to do it at all." It sounded perfectly horrid.
"Is it nice?"
Beth was nearly inaudible with embarrassment.
"I thought so."
Mab's voice was carefully toneless.
"Very nice. But I was only 17, so what did I know?"
"Who was he?"
Osla asked.
"A fellow I shouldn't have listened to."
Mab took another swallow of Giles's gin.
"So is your Philip prompting this desire for information? Or is someone new putting the make on you?"
"Oh, the men I know don't try to put the make on. Maybe a kiss after a date, but that's all. Or they're on the NSIT list."
"NSIT? Beth said.
"Not safe in taxis." "But you want this information for a reason."
Mab refused to be deflected.
"Come on, Oz. You've told us all about your Philip being on the Valiant, and now his eyes are blue-grey and give you spasms. Now give us the goods."
Somehow that cracked the tension. Osla laughed, Mab grinned, and an almost invisible smile escaped Beth.
"I adore Philip," Osla confessed, "and I haven't heard anything from him since Mattapan, so what?"
Beth had frozen at the word Mattapan.
"Nothing."
Beth took another sip from the flask, looking poker-faced.
"And when he comes back from Mattapan, do you think you're getting an offer to become Mrs. Philip?"
Mab paused.
"You know, I don't think you've told us his last name."
"Because he doesn't really have one."
Osla cleared her throat.
He's Prince Philip of Greece."
She looked up. Mab's eyebrows had lofted clear to her hairline, and the flask in Beth's hand hovered half-lowered.
"A bloody prince," Mab told Beth. "Of course, and a foreign prince."
"Not really, he's Danish and German, but he went to school in Scotland, and his uncle is Lord Mountbatten. It's complicated. The family left Greece when he was a baby. He's not heir to the throne."
"Good," drawled Mab, "because it would be funny if I'd just given the facts of life to the future Queen Osla."
"Shut up."
Osla smacked her with a pillow.
"This is exactly why I didn't mention it, because you'd start talking drip, and he's not like that. He's just my Philip."
Mab took the flask from Beth, turning it upside down.
"Not nearly enough gin for this discussion."
Beth actually laughed aloud. Her cheeks had faded from humiliated red to a rosy pink. She looked positively pretty. Osla wondered if Harry thought so too.
Look, Beth, about Harry. I like him, so I want to think he wasn't laying a line on you. But be careful. Beth wrinkled her nose. Someone married. I couldn't. She glanced at the candle stub. It was down to the last half inch of wax. I'd better get to bed. She tucked boots under her arm and padded out. Mab looked at Osler, waiting until they heard the other bedroom door click.
I worry about Beth, she said bluntly. Shy girls like her are just the sort to fall into the wrong man's arms and get in trouble.
I think the appeal of someone like Harry is that he's unattainable, Osler mused, sliding between her sheets. He's a topping good crush for a girl who doesn't actually want to step out of the shadows. I can see Beth as a 90-year-old virgin, breaking codes and living alone with her dog, happy as a clam. A lover or a husband would break that up.
The end of the war will break that up. Who's going to be asking Beth Finch to break codes then? She'll be a spinster at home again.
Mab blew out the candle.
God help her.
Things will be different after the war. Osler stared up into the darkness over her bed. They have to be, or else what's it all for?
Some things never change.
Mab's voice came through the dark, suddenly serious.
Listen, Oz, you might know a bit more biology now, but that doesn't mean you know other things.
Osler stiffened. What do you mean by that?
You don't know how men sometimes use women.
A long exhalation.
How they use and then leave women they never intended to marry. Nice boys do that. Gentlemen do that. Even princes.
Chapter 24. From Bletchley Blethering's, May 1941.
Goodness, who knew that the head of naval section once trod the boards in London pantomimes? Apparently his widow Twanky was a smasher. The things men keep from us, how can we ever truly know them?
Miss Chert.
Francis Gray's warm, courteous voice crackled over the line.
I thought you might enjoy dinner at the Savoy your next evening off.
Mab smiled, waving Osler on ahead. They were both leaving for the evening shift. Will the food be electric yellow?
Dover sole is guaranteed. Nice white food, completely without flavour. Very English.
I'm off Tuesday next. I'm going to Sheffield to see my sister, but I'll take the evening train to London after.
I look forward to it, Miss Chert. Wear skyscraping shoes.
He rang off and Mab's smile slid to a thoughtful frown. This would make her third date with her poet. After the Indian supper at Veraswamy, he'd invited her to a lunchtime concert at the National Gallery, where she'd heard some deeply inexplicable music. And he still puzzled her exceedingly. He barely spoke, but listened attentively. He smiled a good deal, but never laughed. He didn't press to use her first name. He didn't press for anything, as a matter of fact. Mab found Francis Gray something of a mystery.
Is he on your shortlist?
Giles had asked after the Mad Hatters discussed Francis's unsettling war poetry.
I don't think so.
Mab knew when a man was keen, and Francis Gray didn't seem to be. He regarded everything, an air raid alarm, a bowl of mulligatawny soup, Mab in her berry-coloured frock, with the same pleasant remoteness, like he sat friendly and removed behind an invisible curtain. She found herself rereading Myard from cover to cover, looking for clues to how his mind worked. But all the poetry told her was that he'd been a scared boy who'd tried to get rid of his trench nightmares by putting them in verse. He wasn't that boy anymore. So who was he?
Bump him up your list, Giles advised. He's a catch. Parents dead, so no interfering mother-in-law. Owns a good-sized house in Coventry. No millionaire. Nobody ever made a packet off poetry. But his father patented some cough medicine that's done rather well. More than enough to keep you in silk stockings and your little sister in ponies.
I know all that.
Mab always vetted her dates thoroughly.
But I'm not just after silk stockings and ponies, Giles.
Aren't you?
I want someone to be contented with.
She didn't ask for grand romance, but she did want contentment. And Mab didn't think anyone as disinterested in life as Francis Gray had it in him to be content. He was a puzzle, all right, her very own enigma in a park full of them.
I really do not approve of men telephoning, Mrs. Finch appeared in the hallway the minute Mab replaced the handset. Unless they are family.
He's my cousin.
You seem to have a great many cousins. Big family. If you'll excuse me, I've got a long evening shift ahead.
Doing what?
Because you've started coming home with oil droplets on your coughs.
Mrs. Finch smiled, but there was a glint in her eye.
And then I keep finding these, of course. What on earth?
Mab examined the square of numbers scribbled in her own handwriting.
I have no idea.
Ever since Beth had taught her and Osler how to crack a Visionaire square, they'd started using the cipher whenever leaving each other notes. A bit over-elaborate, but none of them could resist. Finally a way to cut out a snooping landlady and drive her mad in the process. The key was always Lassie's.
That is your handwriting, Mrs. Finch accused, waving the square. Must dash, Mrs. F.
The late afternoon was fragrant and beautiful. By the time Mab got off shift, it would be black midnight under a half moon. They'd been so lucky out here in the countryside, no bombing raids to speak of. Last week, London had endured the worst attack since the beginning of the war. Even the perpetually optimistic newspapers couldn't make cheerful hay out of the fact that the House of Commons had been destroyed. Coming through BP's gates and making her way to her hut, Mab had to stand a moment outside the door before she could steel herself to face those hissing, enigmatic machines.
Why haven't I asked for a transfer?
More Wrens had shipped in to service the bombs. Mab was still the only civilian assigned here, probably because they'd forgot she was here at all. If she reminded them, she'd be back on a Typex by next week. But she hated begging out of a job that needed doing, even a job she hated, and bloody hell, she hated the bomb machines. Day shifts weren't so bad. You could step outside for a welcome jolt of sunshine and suck your soul back into your lungs. But on the evening shifts, the hut seemed like an airless capsule in some dark ocean, draining air and cheer away like a leech.
Were you at the Bedford dance?
Wren Stevens asked as she and Mab received their first menu and began plugging Aggie up.
Yes.
Mab stretched to reach a plug at the top. Her turn to be on her feet tonight, as Stevens sat at the checking machine, going over Aggie's settings. Oh, but her toes were going to ache by morning.
I went with a fellow from Hut 7, Stevens went on. Ugh, he was all hands the moment we got on the dance floor.
The men I know don't try to put the make on. Mab could hear Osler's voice asserting that. Lovely, clueless Osler, who thought gentlemen was safe.
Gentlemen don't try to put the make on girls like Osler, Mab thought,
setting Aggie going with a deafening racket.
With girls like me, they aren't so gentlemanly, or so safe.
Aggie clacked, and Mab heard the clack of the register at Selfridge's as she rang up his purchase. His name was Geoffrey Irving. He read French literature at Christ's College, and he'd come to Selfridge's to buy a present for his mother. Mab, behind the counter in her black shopgirl's dress, all of 17 years old, had sold him a silk scarf. He'd sold her a lot of nonsense about how pretty she was.
I wasn't pretty, she thought, looking at that gawky girl who had just hit 5'11" and hadn't ironed Shoreditch out of her vowels yet.
I was available, and I was thrilled to get a date with a university boy. He took her to the cinema, and they were kissing before the newsreel was over, his hand inside her blouse 10 minutes later. He wouldn't have tried that on Osler. What Cambridge boy wanted to be labelled NSIT among all the debutantes of London? But he hadn't hesitated with Mab, and she hadn't stopped him. He had her knickers off within 3 weeks, in the leather backseat of his Bentley convertible, and it had been marvellous. So much for any of those stories about pain and blood the first time.
You're wonderful, he'd panted afterward. Wonderful, Mabel.
And they went again with hardly a pause, Mab blissfully certain she was in love, blissfully sure that this was the start of something special, something lasting. Especially when he said he wanted to take her for a night on the town with his friends.
Stop there, she thought,
mechanically prying open a drum, tweezing two wires apart with exquisite care.
Just stop.
It was hard to stop in the airless depth of the night shift. Night shift was when all Mab's demons came out to play. She still remembered the dress she'd bought to meet Geoffrey's university chums, sunshine yellow rayon, with a big red silk rose at the shoulder. She'd spent half her savings on it, certain it was the chicest thing she'd ever owned.
Very nice, Geoffrey had said when she came tripping out to meet the Bentley,
and his two friends had echoed him in identical Cambridge drawls.
How about a little joyride before the party?
They were already passing a flask back and forth when she hopped in.
Stupid girl, Mab thought,
swapping out the wheel order on the drums.
There wasn't any party. The party was you.
17-year-old Mab would have sniffed that out if they'd been Shoreditch boys like the ones who'd been whistling at her legs since she was 12. But 17-year-old Mab, who was already head over heels for Geoffrey, assumed that young men who read literature at Cambridge were gentlemen. Stupid girl. She and Geoffrey had been kissing in the back seat, the taste of brandy on his lips, when the Bentley cantered to a crooked halt and one of his friends began fumbling under her skirt. She pulled back, smacking him off with a protest of, "Hey!" And Geoffrey laughed.
"Wait your turn,"
he told his friend lazily, pulling Mab's sleeve down and nibbling at her shoulder.
"I brought her. I go first."
Stupid, maybe, Mab thought, mechanically tweezing the wires apart on another drum. But not slow. There had been one ice-cold moment of incomprehension, looking at the boy she'd fallen for. But only that one moment. Then she'd shoved him away with all her strength, and there were hands at her back and on her breasts, and voices laughing.
"You didn't say she was such a firebrand!"
Maybe they'd thought it would be easy, that they'd each take a turn in the back seat while the other two waited their turn smoking by the bumper. But they were all drunk, and Mab was taller than any of them and blazing with fear and fury. Geoffrey had a set of triple-scored scratches down each side of his face, and his friend was bent over his balls in soundless groaning. His third friend had turned around to lend a hand from the front seat, and Mab had yanked his hair so hard a handful of short strands came out in her fist. She had shrieked the whole time, cursing and snarling with rage and terror. It took all three of them to wrestle her out of the car, flailing and clawing all the way, getting another rake of her nails across Geoffrey's neck as they dropped her in the road. Mab was on her feet in a flash, knees stinging and scraped, pulling her shoe off and gripping the sharp heel in one trembling hand. "You touch me!" she grated, shaking so hard she could barely stand. "And I will drive this through your fucking eye!"
"Walk your common little arse and your common little rayon frock back to Shoreditch, you cheap, stupid slut,"
Geoffrey bit off in that posh voice that had always turned her knees to butter, and the Bentley swerved off in a blare of headlights.
"Go to well, you pathetic 3-inch excuse for a man!"
Mab shrieked after it, seeing the outraged white smudge of Geoffrey's face before the car disappeared, leaving her standing on the midnight road somewhere on the outskirts of London, no handbag or money, one shoe in her hand and the other nowhere to be seen, yellow dress torn all the way to her waist, vibrating with vast, humiliated sobs. It had taken her 4 hours to walk home, limping barefoot through the streets. 3 words vibrated through her with every step. Cheap, stupid slut. Cheap, stupid slut. She'd walked into the kitchen on bloodied feet, every tear long sobbed out and dried on her cheeks, and she'd thanked her lucky stars Mum was asleep. Mab peeled off her ragged stockings, her torn slip, the dress she'd thought so beautiful, and chucked it all in the bin. She'd stood tall and naked in the kitchen, lighting a cigarette and smoking it all the way down with a face like stone. That was when she decided she was done being Mabel. Mabel was young and dim and easily fooled. She was going to be Mab instead. Cool, imperious, untouchable Queen Mab.
Chapter 25. From Bletchley Blethering's, June 1941.
B.B. spotted Dilly Knox coming to work in his pyjamas again. The ladies of his section are all too brilliant to be minding their boss's wardrobe, but surely there are any number of fashion designers twiddling their thumbs. If Mr. Hartnell and Mr. Molyneux can dress royalty and wrens, can't they be seconded to dress Dilly Knox? There's a war on, after all.
"Ladies, you've been reassigned."
Beth was down the rabbit hole on a new message, and didn't look up at Dilly until Peggy reached over and took the pencil out of her hand.
"Italian naval traffic is being rerouted to another section," Dilly went on,
tugging the bathrobe sash holding up his trousers.
"Since there's now so little of it."
"Not much naval traffic when you don't have a navy anymore," Peggy smirked. Beth smirked back, though the thought of their Matapan triumph gave her an odd feeling now that she knew Osler's princely bow had been involved in that battle. Beth usually forgot that the puzzle work she loved meant something concrete for the troops, meant life or death for men far away on a dazzling blue sea. She'd been very glad she couldn't say as much to Osler. "It was my work that flung your boyfriend's ship into the thick of the biggest naval battle since Trafalgar. Does that make it my fault, at least a little bit, that you have no idea if he's alive or dead?"
We've been given a new puzzle, Dilly continued,
passing out messages and rods.
It's a proper jabberwock, I warn you.
Beth flipped through the stack, frowning. Something looked different.
The Abwehr Enigma.
Dilly saw the blank looks between the girls like Beth, who could work German cribs but not speak the language.
The enigma used by German military intelligence. Just call it the spy enigma. Our intelligence chaps can find the German agents on our soil and feed them false information. But we haven't a clue if it's being believed by the Abwehr officers running the show in Berlin.
What's different about their enigma? Peggy frowned.
They use a four-wheel machine, not a three-wheel. Four-wheel settings to find instead of three, and they turn over a deal more frequently. It's a beast, Dilly concluded,
running a hand over his hair, which was already thinner than it had been when Beth first laid eyes on him.
Welchman thinks if the boys in his hut can't break it, it can't be done. Let's prove him wrong.
Beth had a go for 6 hours, and all she got was a headache. It felt like her first weeks in the cottage, flailing in the dark, and she could see matching discouragement from all the others. But Dilly was sanguine.
Come back fresh tomorrow and go at it again. We'll get there. Blasted, where's my pipe?
Beth found the pipe under a German dictionary, handed it to him, and trailed dejectedly home. She was still wandering mentally among four-letter indicators as she leashed up boots and set out on her mother's list of errands, fetching the post, a stop by the chemist. Mother's little helper. Only mother's little helper wasn't quite so content anymore. Mother's little helper now spent her time counting the hours until she could go back on shift. Beth sighed, tugging boots towards the chemist, where she had to step around a pair of huge booted feet.
Harry?
She blinked. His head jerked up. Clearly he'd dozed off sitting on the shop bench, leaning against the wall.
Sorry, I'm waiting for the chemist to mix something up, and a week on the night shift got the better of me.
He had circles like tar under his eyes, and his collar was a wrinkled mess. Beth knew Hut 8 was working round the clock on the U-boat traffic. It wasn't any secret that the Wolf Packs had been bringing down close to 100 Allied ships a month between March and June. Harry gave a hard blink, squinting up at Beth.
I haven't seen you since the dance, have I?
Where we danced and talked code-breaking techniques, and people apparently thought we were... Beth felt her cheeks colour. She'd been appalled when Osla and Mab thought something romantic might have been going on. Embarrassed, wondering if she'd given Harry the wrong idea. And ashamed, because yes, maybe Beth had developed a harmless crush on her favourite BP colleague, and only just realised it. Either way, she'd resolved to steer clear of Harry in future. Picking up a toothbrush for my dad, she murmured, edging past. But Boots had stopped to sniff at Harry's outstretched hand.
I'm getting a tincture for Christopher,
scratching Boots's jaw.
I don't know if it does any good, but the doctor has faith in it.
Beth hesitated despite herself. How long, I mean, when did he contract polio?
He was 18 months old.
Harry's voice went flat.
Careening around the lawn one moment, the next moment screaming. By morning he couldn't stand. By evening he was in hospital, in an iron lung.
Harry looked up.
Have you ever seen one of those damned torture chambers? Just an enormous metal cylinder with his tiny head sticking out. Even when he was moved to the next ward, he'd lie there in a sterile crib, crying and crying. And we'd stand at the door on the other side of the chicken wire, not able to come close because of quarantine. 5 more months before we got him back for good.
Harry's big hand lay still across Boots's head.
We're lucky he has use of his arms. We're lucky, I keep telling myself that. But he's in and out of hospital all the time. He'll need to have his ankle fused at some point to stabilize the foot. And he's such an active little sprat. He cries out of pure rage whenever he's put into a cast.
The chemist poked his head outside.
Your tincture's made up, Mr. Zarb.
Harry gave Boots a final scratch, rising. Beth followed him inside and took a toothbrush from the rack, arriving at the counter as Harry was putting down coins. The chemist's wife was eyeing him with distaste, gaze travelling over his vast height, his shabby tweed jacket with the button missing.
I don't know if I should be serving you.
She pushed his change across the counter with a fingertip.
A strong young fellow, not in uniform. Shame on you. There's a war on, you know.
Harry paused, looking at her.
I know, he said evenly. I know.
He leaned forward until his nose nearly touched the woman's, even as she pressed backward with eyes growing round.
I know.
He shoved the coins back across the counter so hard they flew up, some hitting her, some falling to the floor. He grabbed his tincture bottle and banged out, shop door rebounding against the wall. Beth pushed her own exact change for the toothbrush at the wide-eyed chemist's wife and went after him.
Harry, she called, then hesitated.
She had no idea what to say when people were angry or upset. He stood struggling with his old bicycle leaned up against the lamppost, hands moving too roughly to disengage the chain, not looking up.
I could use some help with a problem, Beth said at last.
Not much in the way of comfort, but work was a comfort in its way. Or maybe not a comfort, but a drug. It certainly felt that way to her. A drug that could make you forget anything, even for a tiny space of time, the horror of seeing a child in pain.
What problem?
He looked up, blinking as if his eyes were prickling, and Beth's embarrassed determination to steer clear of him dissolved. He hadn't been feeding her lines at the dance, for all Mab's cynicism about married men looking for fun. He wasn't going to try anything, and Beth didn't want him to, crush or not. First and foremost, Harry had always been a friend.
What can you tell me about working a system with four-letter indicators?
Beth asked, making sure there was no one in earshot. His gaze went from angry to speculative in a blink.
Four wheels,
she nodded. He unchained his bicycle and began to walk it along rather than mounting up, and Beth fell into step on the other side.
K-Enigma uses a four-wheel machine,
Harry said when they were clear of the village. The country road was empty, elms arching overhead, robins twittering.
I did a bit with that. A four-letter indicator means there's a settable Umkehrwaltz.
It's difficult.
Beth could feel both their minds ranging ahead in unison, like a pair of greyhounds bounding down this path into a gallop.
We haven't got much in the way of textual cribs.
I might be able to help there. Have you got a bit of paper?
Chapter 26.
Hello, Princess. I'm back in England. Did my letter after Matapan go astray? Everything's been chaos. I've come to take my sub-lieutenant's courses and exams. For the moment, I'm bunking with the Mountbattens. Tell me you can get to London Saturday next. Philip.
You'll miss the next tea party.
Beth looked up from the rug where she was brushing boots.
We're discussing curry on Jeeves. Bugger Jeeves. Philip's not dead.
Now that Osler had the proof in his handwriting, she could laugh at her own fears. But like a child terrified of a monster in the closet, you could only laugh at the fear when the light was switched on.
This one?
Osler pulled out a dress.
It's the very latest go. How do I look?
Jumpy, said Mab from the bed.
Like a Borgia who has suddenly remembered that he has forgotten to shove cyanide in the consommé and the dinner gong due any minute.
Osler gave her a look. Mab held up Carry On Jeeves.
Unlike you, I did the reading. Oh, go boil your head, Queen Mab. Wait, do my hair. You set the most topping waves.
Euston Station on Saturday night was thronged with harried women and jostling servicemen, but the whole crowd might as well have been shadows to Osler as she ran for the Great Hall. As a little girl forever shuttling back and forth between London and her latest boarding school, Osler had hurried countless times under this hall's coffered ceiling, always outstripping her luggage in her haste to get above ground for sunshine and the start of summer holes. But today she stopped dead in the middle of the throng, not caring if she ever saw sunshine again. Because there he stood at the foot of the sweeping double flight of stairs, a man in naval uniform and greatcoat, hat over blonde hair, shoulders wide and feet braced, profile bent over a letter. The sight of him nearly stopped Osler's heart. Philip looked up as if he'd felt her gaze. He looked more like a Viking than ever, golden, hard, tanned dark by the Mediterranean sun. His gaze hunted over her a little uncertainly, as if trying to merge the irreverent Osler he'd met at Claridge's in a boiler suit with this Osler, her serious face, her blush pink crepe dress, her little fuchsia hat tilted over one eye. An Osler who, unbeknownst to him, had spent her day translating German naval secrets.
Oz, he began, and trailed off.
Philip,
She too was suddenly floundering. I'm on shift tomorrow morning. I only have this evening. Then I have to catch the train back. Desperate for distraction, she gestured at the great hall around them. Euston's a bit of an eyesore, isn't it? I always preferred coming into Paddington when I was little, because it had the statue of the unknown soldier. You know the one, standing there in his bronze greatcoat, reading a letter from home. I always wanted to ask him who wrote the letter. Was she beautiful? Did he come back to her? Did she love him?
Did he ever answer you?
Philip's eyes drifted over her face as if he hadn't quite remembered her right. They hadn't seen each other for more than a year, Osla thought. She hadn't remembered him quite right either. His eyes weren't blue-grey. They were just blue. So very blue. She took a step closer. No, he never answered, being bronze and all.
I suppose I could answer for him.
Philip held up the letter in his hand, and she saw her own writing.
The girl who wrote this letter is definitely beautiful, and he definitely survived and came back to her.
Philip trailed off before the third question. Did she love him? Did he even want an answer? Osler knew it would be very easy to guide this train onto safer tracks. They hadn't spent very much time together after all, and it had been more than a year. She could play the flirtatious chum, trill, "Darling Phil, how long it's been!" And then they'd splash out at the Savoy and part with no more heartache than any other set of friends who met for a fizzing night on the town. That would probably be the wiser course, Osler thought, remembering Mab's nighttime warning about princes and the girls they wouldn't consider marrying. But the third question, did she love him? Osler took two steps forward, flung her arms around Philip's neck, and pressed her lips to his. He pulled her against him with a yank, lifting her up onto her toes. She was too busy drowning in his kisses to notice when the lights of Euston Station went out.
I think we're stuck here, Princess.
Such a tragedy, Sailor.
The air raid siren still sounded somewhere in the distance, but Oslo could not hear the drone of planes. If bombs were falling, they were on the other side of London. The station lights had come on again, but only partly. Their side was enveloped in shadow. Philip sat with his back against the station wall, with Osler curled on his lap, his greatcoat draped about her shoulders so he could wrap his arms around her inside it. His hat lay on the ground with Osler's fuchsia toque on top of it beside her handbag. None of the others caught in the station paid any attention to the midshipman and his code girl, hidden in the shadow of the hall, clinging so tight they nearly fused. A sound clattered outside, and Philip's face lifted from Osler's neck, his every muscle tensing beneath her.
"Just the Ek-Ek guns," she murmured, tugging his head back to hers. "Our side. You get used to the sound."
She was drunk on him, every nerve in her body singing. They'd kissed before, but with care, standing on doorsteps where they couldn't be tempted too far. Not like this, open-mouthed and yearning, hands sliding under sleeves and inside collars, the whole surface of her skin aching.
"You're so calm about the air raids," Philip muttered against her lips.
"Londoners have become terribly blasé about the Blitz." The travellers caught in the station had settled down to wait it out, unwrapping sandwiches and chatting to their neighbours. "Euston took some hits last year, but she's still standing."
"Thank God you're bedded in bucks away from the worst of it."
He kissed her jaw, fingertips sliding along her skin inside her neckline. She could feel his grin against her cheek as he touched the hard little lump of his naval insignia, pinned to her brassiere between her breasts.
"You kept it?"
"I nearly had it stolen once." Osler pushed her face into the hollow of his neck and rested there, tasting the salt of his skin. "I came to the Café de Paris on my night off. The boy I was dancing with, he..." She shut her eyes, seeing poor Charlie's lungs exploded out onto the front of his uniform. "The club was bombed, and a looter tried to get my jewellery. A stranger ran him off, took care of me."
J.P.E.C. Cornwall, whoever he was.
Osler hadn't received any response to her letter. "I kept calling him Philip."
"I'm not Philip, sweetheart. What's your name?"
Philip was here now, arms tightening around her, one hand rubbing her bare shoulder where her sleeve had slipped down, the other stroking her silk-stockinged calf. Osler couldn't remember the last time she'd felt the world could be born simply because someone was holding her. It dizzied her, this mixture of simple comfort and raw desire.
"I'm sorry I wasn't there," Philip said quietly.
You were headed to fight at Cape Matapan. And I think one of my billet mates knows something about what orders sent you there.
I wasn't in any danger, Oz. We were on them that night like foxes in a henhouse.
His lips touched her hair, his body suddenly still against hers.
I was on the Valiant searchlights. I'd flip the midship light and pick out the enemy cruiser until our guns set it ablaze. Then the gunnery officer would shout, "Train left or train right," and as soon as I lit the next one up, she'd be blotted out stem to stern. 2 8-inch gun Italian cruisers sunk in 5 minutes. It was as near murder as anything could be in wartime. The cruisers just burst into tremendous sheets of flame.
He exhaled into her hair.
I dream about them.
I dream about the Café de Paris. I wake up smelling the fire, and for a moment I think I've gone mad.
Don't say that, Oz.
He was already tense. Now he went rigid.
Not ever.
She pulled back, looked at him through the shadows.
Bit of a sore point with me.
He made himself shrug.
My mother went mad.
Alice of Battenberg, from one of the German noble houses. You've hardly ever mentioned her.
She had a breakdown when I was 8 or 9. So many doctors. They couldn't decide if she was neurotic or paranoid schizophrenic or...
A long pause, his eyes fixed past Oz's shoulder.
I wasn't there when they took her away. They sent the children out for the day, but I heard later how she tried to run. They had to put her in restraints and inject her before they could bundle her into a car and take her to Bellevue in Switzerland.
Osler felt him breathing against her, unevenly. You were so young.
It was the last time our family lived together. She was released eventually, but by then my father was in France, my sisters were married, I was in England.
Osler's arms tightened around his neck.
It's just what happened, he said roughly. She went mad. The family broke up. I just had to get on with it. You do. One does. Besides, she got better. She came out of the asylum, returned to Athens. She's still there, living quietly.
And you've still had no real home since she was taken away, Osler thought. How did she do it? Recover from that?
Iron will? I don't know.
Philip pulled her closer into his chest.
So, don't even joke about going mad, Oz.
I won't. She took his secret like the gift it was, painful and precious. And before you ask, I won't tell anyone, not ever.
I know that. I don't trust many people, but I know the ones I can.
He buried his nose in her hair, inhaling.
You smell so good. I live on a tin can with 100 chaps, you have no idea. You smell like peonies, Earl Grey, honey.
They kissed and talked and kissed some more inside the shelter of his greatcoat, long past the all-clear siren. The lights stayed out at their end of the station, even as trains began to rumble through again, and passers-by resumed their bustle. Osler was dozing in the curve of Philip's arm when he stirred, pressing his lips to her temple.
Your train's coming in 15 minutes, princess.
We never even got out of the station, and it's already time to get you home. How long before you ship out? She tried to say it lightly, but fear clutched her stomach. I only just got you back.
Months. I need to study for my lieutenant's exams.
Under the shelter of the greatcoat, he helped her hook buttons that had come unbuttoned. Osler smiled as she did up his uniform collar, which had come open under her hands, so she could slide her fingers over his chest. What you could do under a greatcoat in dim light during an air raid? If they hadn't been in a public place, who knew what might have happened? Philip set her on her feet, looking much less flushed and rumpled as he donned his cap. Some alchemy of royal blood, maybe. The ability to compose oneself for the public eye in a blink. But he's not just a prince, Osler thought. He's my Philip. And she grinned as he buttoned his greatcoat rather hastily, because she had a much better idea, bless you, Mab, about the biological state a man might be in after hours and hours of canoodling against a wall. Welcome back, sailor, she said softly.
I'm not just back.
He pulled her against him, rested his chin on top of her head.
I'm home.
Home, Osler thought. The second of those twin burning pole stars toward which she tried to steer her life. A job worth doing, and a home to come back to. that she finally have both. And for the rest of June, all the way to Golden Autumn, Osler vibrated bright-eyed and joyous between the two, running straight from her grueling hours of translation in Hut 4 to throw herself into Philip's arms in London, riding between Bletchley and Euston Station, barely able to see for stars.